طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. Sharif Fahm created This Week in Palestine, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. Christian Zionists form a dominant portion of the so-called Christian right. They are a major player in the evangelical movement and a power player in the well-organized pro-Israel lobby in the United States. 40% of the current Republican Party identify as evangelicals. 40%. So when we think about the base of the pro-Israeli lobby in the United States, we cannot think it is just the Jewish community. It also includes a massive Christian religious right. Today we focus on an examination of the Christian Zionists' influence on the development of U.S. policies concerning Israel-Palestine. Their clout in Congress is a major factor in the refusal of our elected representatives to take a stand against the human rights abuses of the Israeli government. An excellent forum on this issue was held at the Harvard Divinity School last October and is the focus of our program this morning. Diane Moore begins the discussion with the introduction of the panel.
Hello, everyone. I'm Diane Moore, and I'm the Faculty Director of Religion and Public Life at the Harvard Divinity School. I want to warmly welcome you all to the Christian Right and Shaping of American Policies in Palestine, Israel. This webinar is part of the Religion, Conflict, and Peace Initiative webinar series and is co-sponsored by the Project on Negotiation at Harvard Law School. The Religion, Conflict, and Peace Initiative is a program of religion and public life whose mission is to enhance the public understanding of religion in service of just peace. In all our work, we centralize an analysis of how structural injustices thwart human and planetary flourishing, and how a more capacious and complex understanding of religion can yield fresh insights into contemporary challenges and opportunities for just peace building. The primary case study we're focusing on for the Religion, Conflict, and Peace Initiative is Palestine-Israel. Our aim is to stretch the scholarly discourse around religion and the practices of peace building and examine the decolonial potentialities of art, religion, and identity transformation. Today's webinar examines the political ideologies and religious beliefs of the Christian right in the United States and their role in influencing policies in Palestine-Israel. We are incredibly honored to have with us today three guests who can speak authentically and eloquently about these critical questions. And I'm going to ask them to come on screen now as I introduce them. Gregory Cahill is the co-founder and president of Telos, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit that equips American leaders and their communities to better engage seemingly intractable conflicts. Greg is a lawyer and also an adjunct professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, where he often co-teaches a course called Covering Religion. He's a former fellow of our Religion, Conflict, and Peace Initiative as well. It's wonderful to have him back for this conversation. Thank you, Greg. Professor Melanie McAllister is Director of Undergraduate Studies and Professor of American Studies and International Affairs at George Washington University. Her research focuses on the multiple global visions produced by and for Americans. She explores the ways in which cultural and political history intersect and on the role of religion and culture in shaping U.S. interests in other parts of the world. Specifically, she studies nationalism and transnationalism, cultural theory, religion and culture, the rhetoric of foreign policy, and cultural and media history, including television, film, print, and digital. In 2018, Dr. McAllister published The Kingdom of God Has No Borders, A Global History of American Evangelicals, which explores how U.S. evangelical Christians, white and people of color, have constructed their understandings of and relationships with people in the Middle East and Africa. I highly recommend this book. Wonderful to have you with us, Melanie. Thank you for being here. And Dr. James Dogby is the president and co-founder of the Arab American Institute, a Washington, D.C. organization which serves as a political and policy research arm of the Arab American community. He is also director of Zogby Research Services, a firm that has conducted groundbreaking surveys across the Middle East. In September of 2013, President Obama appointed Dr. Zogby to serve as the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, and he was reappointed to that commission in 2015. In 2000, 2008, and 2016, he served as advisor to the Gore, Obama, and Sanders presidential campaigns, and currently serves as chair of the Democratic National Committee's Ethnic Council, an umbrella organization of Democratic Party leaders of European and Mediterranean descent. Welcome, Jim. Wonderful to have you with us. Thank you for joining. So, Greg, the first question is going to you. Can you briefly sketch for us the theology underlying the Christian right's support of Israel annexationist policies and how your work has navigated it over time? Also, if you could offer your insights regarding why this issue matters to publics beyond the Christian right and those concerned with Israel-Palestine.
Sure. Diane, thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored to be part of this panel, particularly with Melanie and Jim, and looking forward to learning a lot from them. Let me start with the second part of your question, the why this conversation is important. That's one that we skip over. I come from a Palestinian Christian background, and so I've been connected to this issue for many years. I formally advised the Palestinian leadership on negotiations. And one aspect that gets sort of some attention recently is the way that America's relationship to the Middle East confounds and complicates things for those of us who value fundamental human rights for everyone, for all Palestinians and all Israelis. One of the things that we overlook, though, is that this is the Holy Land, and some of the constituencies that care the most and will care are faith communities, and particularly Christians. Historically, with this conflict, for example, for those of you who are familiar with the history of this conflict, Balfour, Lord Balfour of the Balfour Declaration, which is kind of synonymous with the birth of the modern Israeli-Palestinian conflict and many tellings of the story, Sykes of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, many of these historic figures were also people of faith, and specifically evangelical Christians who had a certain theological outlook. And that's important to name because we can draw a line from these folks in Great Britain all the way through the Trump administration with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Vice President Mike Pence, and we might want to go into some of this later. But why is that significant? The basic punchline here is that there is no path to a sustainable and just peace, whatever form that might take, in the Holy Land without accounting for many of these communities, bypassing them, engaging them, getting other folks to help get into the real difficult work of peace building that centers fundamental human rights. So your first part of your question about theology is very connected to that, because theology is simply a religious worldview. How do we understand scriptures? How do we understand what God's larger plan is for humanity and for us? Worldview, whether religious or not, it shapes all of our behavior and our interventions in this world, whether we care to admit it or not. Debatable premise, but we can say something about that. So I'll be very brief on the theology because I know we've got these other great commentators here. The short answer is there are actually several different Christian Zionist theologies in America today. Historically, going back to Britain, as I mentioned, there's something called dispensationalism. Big word. All it means is there was a John Darby, British theologian who really codified the foundational ideas of Christian Zionism. And dispensationalism divided the Bible into certain dispensations or periods of time to understand God's evolving plan from the beginning until end times. And in that plan, Israel played a central role, Israel as God's chosen people. And the covenant that God made with Abraham in the Old Testament was seen as extending to the modern day to the Jewish people today. So there was this conflation even before the state of Israel was born in 1948 with these Old Testament realities and events. So dispensationalism basically said that, you know, the end times, for the end times and Jesus to return, some things would have to happen, including the Jewish people returning, quote unquote, to the land of Israel, at which time the Armageddon would happen. All but 144,000 Jews, under some telling of the story, would be slaughtered. The remaining 12,000 for 12 tribes of Israel would convert. Jesus would return. This real fire and brimstone thing. And that was the real foundation of dispensationalism. That took some hold with the establishment of Israel in 1948, which many Christians interpreted as a fulfillment of biblical prophecy. But since then, in particular in the States, there's been a differentiation. So Christian Zionism, some folks don't put much emphasis on the end times philosophy anymore, but pretty much all Christian Zionists who are motivated by a theological worldview will say that, one, Israel holds a special place in God's plan. Two, the Jewish people are God's chosen people. Three, modern Israel is a fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And then they'll cite Genesis 12:3, which says, God said to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. So they see this duty, this religious duty to help bless Israel and the Jewish people and also not be cursed. Politically, that's manifest into one of the most consequential movements in America today. Tens of millions of Americans identify as Christian Zionist. Definitely not all evangelical Christians and definitely not all Christians. We can say more about that later. But they support Israel in this hardcore pro-Israel form, including the annexation policies that you mentioned, in a way that includes tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars a year, plus a lot of the political support that we see that has increasingly been codified within conservative Republican circles.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much, Greg. I mean, that's a you've just consolidated a really rich and important set of narratives, I think, that define our current moment in really eloquent ways. One thing I just want to highlight that you represented that's really so important here is that it's easy to paint evangelical Christianity in one broad stroke, which you clearly are not doing. But I just want to underscore that critical distinction. And even among Christian Zionists, there are different strands of thought relevant to how people come to the policy and theological conclusions that they do. But those, I completely agree with those three overarching foundations that you cite that articulate people's motivations currently and the way it's playing itself out in public policy. So thank you. Thanks so much for that. Jim, I'm going to turn to you now. Based on your vast and incredibly long experience in the policy world and intimate familiarity with the shaping of American foreign policies in the MENA region and vis-a-vis Palestine, Israel, how would you characterize the influence of the Christian right over time, and how has this influence manifested?
Well, I'm going to combine a couple different worlds I live in. Okay. One obviously is the doctoral work I did in religion, and the other is the political work I do all the time, and then the work I do as a pollster, and make the observation that we have to look at this at levels. There certainly are the Hagees of the world and the Pat Robertsons of the world and the Falwells of the world who have projected a view not just of the Middle East, but of politics in general, and mobilize the base around that. And then there are then there's the base that they have. I dare say that most of the base of a Pat Robertson had no idea at all about the end of times. And frankly would say, oh man, I don't give a shit about that. I'm in it for, you know, that it's just, it wasn't an issue. It's not something they knew about, cared about. And actually it would scare the heck out of them. If you'd say, you know, you're in a movement here that wants to see the end of the world come real quick. Right. And Israel's going to say blah, blah, blah. They don't know anything about it. Robertson would go on about it on his show, but the reason why people listened had nothing to do with the sort of the theology that he projected. There were other issues there. The Robertson movement in 88, which eventually took over about a third of the Republican Party, was based on cultural issues, domestic cultural issues that grew into and took different forms. I mean, there was there is the Christian right, but there's also the Gingrich right, which both coalesced around the Trump right. That is a manifestation of largely white, largely middle-aged, middle-class folks from communities that have been dislocated economically and socially and culturally. I mean, these are folks who turn on TV and say, "I can't let my kids watch that. That's not, you know, I don't know what to do with this. The world is changing. They don't know what to do with it." In 2008, they woke up and in literally overnight, unemployment doubled. Homes, one out of every five homes was in foreclosure. Pensions lost 30-40%, and they were completely lost in the middle of all of this. And these folks that were preaching at them were giving them a message of entitlement. And Israel fit into that in a weird way because Israel was strong. I call them anti-Semites for Israel because they are, because of their overall cultural orientation, they're not favorable toward Jews domestically. And Trump, as you saw in Trump's messaging, there was a lot of that, right? That was very incendiary about Jews. I like Jews to handle my money because they know how to do it. Or, you know, he talked about the little Jewish guy leaning over his accountants and stuff. But at the same time, Israel was strong and stood up against Muslims, stood up against the threat, the other that was challenging us. And so I think that the leadership of the Christian right, separate from the base, saw this opportunity to build their movement around a broad range of issues. Initially wasn't Israel, but had to do with domestic stuff, everything from abortion to gays to sort of, what do you call it, I forget the term that one uses about...
transgender?
Dog whistles about racism and about economic entitlement. And at the point where Israel becomes a factor, it fit into the schema of the us versus them cultural mold that they created. But again, I think that the theology never was an issue for most people. It wasn't something they knew or cared about. And one evidence that I find in that is that if we look at the polling as it's evolving in the country, as the demographics of the country are reflecting different views on the Middle East, I mean, people have argued that there was a partisan split on the Middle East. It's really not partisan, it's demographic. It's young people, people of color, educated women in one corner, and then largely white, middle-class, middle-aged, you know, folks over here. The born-again versus the not born-again. It's interesting when you look at that among evangelicals, the same holds true. Young evangelicals have very different views than older evangelicals. Black evangelicals, very different than white evangelicals. Sure, there are some in each camp, but overall, the trend line among those who identify as born again or as evangelical is to move more toward their demographic cohort than their religious view cohort. I think that's on that cultural side, I would say that the influence they have has become substantial because they have wedded themselves in the Republican Party. They have brought money. They've brought votes. People don't vote Israel necessarily, but they vote for what their religious leadership, quote unquote, their political, in this case, cultural leadership, quote unquote, will say to vote for. And they've become a stalwart component. About 40+% of the Republican Party base right now is identified as born again. Yes, there will be those who will sort of get ecstatic over the embassy in Jerusalem. But for the most part, those aren't the issues, I think, that motivate people on the evangelical right. That's not the issue. That it's not as big an issue as abortion or gay rights. And even those issues, I dare say, are not ultimate. You know, abortion's an issue for the religious right until they get somebody pregnant and need to get an abortion. Gay rights are an issue on the evangelical right until their child comes out as gay or their best friend or neighbor comes out as gay. You know, I mean, there is that sense that this is a theological sort of overlay that covers a deeper cultural sense of dislocation that needs to be addressed primarily. That's the issue. So I don't get into theological debates with folks. I look at where the culture is and where they're, what are they saying to me when they say God this or that? You know, it's the same as like when you're growing up and somebody would say God damn, and they, and it's like what he's really saying is I'm angry, which is a way of saying I'm angry. It's kind of the same thing in this world too. I peel off the overlay and I look at what's under it and what are they saying? They want tough guys to beat up Muslims. They want somebody that they can count on as strong, like you know the sort of the Superman that fights against the bad guys. And they follow their leaders who represent to them a range of issues that they feel strongly about, more strongly, I dare say, than Israel. But they'll be with them on that too, as long as it's serving that broader purpose. I hope that made some sense.
It absolutely did. And I've got a few comments I'd love to make. I'll just make two briefly. First of all, I really appreciate your challenge to the notion that these become theological, as though theological beliefs are somehow discrete and overriding from other embedded social, cultural, historic experiences. So religion, like all of these frameworks and worldviews, are always embedded. It's always intersecting with these other questions. And it's also permeable and malleable. I was just reminded 100 years ago, my own doctoral research, I was doing work on the history of Protestant Christian statements on reproductive rights and abortion. And the Southern Baptists in the 1970s, who are now ardent opponents of abortion, actually passed many resolutions in the early 70s and early 80s that supported the moral legitimacy of abortion under certain circumstances. And then in 2001, those were shifted dramatically. So again, not to make any commentary about what's right or wrong in that arena, but just to say these are really permeable and malleable. Mm-hmm. And then are influenced by a whole host of cultural and social historical factors. So thanks so much for that overview and those insights. And Melanie, to you here, you most recently you wrote about a campaign focused on persecuted Christians in the world as a form of evangelical internationalism. How can we understand Christian evangelicalism globally and intergenerationally? And why might this matter to the broader conversation today about the role of the Christian right in shaping policies in Palestine, Israel, and the broader MENA or SWANA region? Further, and in light of your recent article on evangelical internationalism, how can we understand why the plight of Christian Palestinians, especially, is exempt from the broader focus on Christian persecutions in the MENA region?
Thank you. Thank you for that question. It's really great to get to be here and talk about some of these issues. Yeah, I think that in my recent book and in some articles I've written, I've focused a lot on this movement in on behalf of persecuted Christians, because it has become, I would argue, an overarching emotional or affective framework how that shapes how American evangelicals and other some other Christians see their place in the world. I mean, in the world, globally speaking. So that, you know, in the 60s or 70s, you might talk about sponsoring a child who was poor. But now, if you're an American evangelical, you sponsor a Christian, a persecuted child. You know, and the language of persecution, the idea that Christians are persecuted globally, particularly by Muslims, but not only, has become a major through line that crosses some liberal and conservative lines. It has was behind the movement for the International Religious Freedom Act in 1998. It has been central to the last two religious freedom forums that Trump and Pence held over the last couple of years of that administration. And the language, and it shaped President Trump's immigration policy. So the idea that Christians are suffering at the hands of persecuting others, and that American Christians who have become American evangelical Christians have become, like other Christians, actually much more aware of themselves as part of a global community, as a minority of Christians in the world, and as a part of a global community of Christians. This is a good thing. It's good to actually recognize those connections for any of us. Americans are so famously solipsistic in this way. But that the way that connection has been framed has been, on the one hand, sort of understanding the situation or status of Christians in other parts of the world, but on the other hand, seeing things, and this kind of comes back to one of the things that Dr. Zabi was saying, is seeing things through the lens of religion instead of seeing the rich context in which things happen. So if American evangelicals want to understand what's going on in Turkey or Nigeria or Sudan or Iraq, they often frame it as Christian-Muslim conflict, instead of seeing that there's ethnic issues, there are issues of finances, there's issues of long and troubled interscene politics domestically that get framed for Americans as good old-fashioned religious conflict that we can take the side of the good Christians against the evil others. So this persecuted Christians movement has been incredibly powerful. It has made a huge difference in how American evangelicals narrate their relationship with other parts of the world. And you might think, as you suggest, that, well, if they're going to start thinking about Christians who are having a tough time, wouldn't that put them on the side of the Palestinians? I mean, you know, after all. And for a few people, it actually has done that. There has been some more increasing recognition of Palestinian Christians as a group of people that maybe American evangelicals need to be talking to and recognizing for some subset of American evangelicals, because those Palestinian Christians are also recognized and respected in the global arena by Christians in Nigeria or South Asia or Europe in far more greater numbers than they are in the US. And again, there's a kind of global conversation happening. But I would also say that the reason that Palestinians have been largely ignored is that the fundamental thrust of this movement has been to highlight Muslims or Islam as the danger to Christians. And Israel and pro-Israel activists in the United States have been actively supportive of this movement for that reason. And so even though in my book and in my work, I try to show that this is not a giant conspiracy and that there is actually good reason to be thinking about the status of Christians or any other group of people who might be suffering and hungry and suffering from HIV/AIDS, and that sometimes this awareness has actually forced American evangelicals to take seriously debt relief to Africa, HIV/AIDS, you know, poverty, all of those things. But at the same time, when they start focusing on persecution, it has been shaped largely or significantly through an anti-Muslim narrative. And that actually it has been infused with pro-Israeli sentiment and with the idea that Israel is the kind of ally for the U.S. in the Middle East, vis-a-vis Muslim majority countries and in other parts of the world too, actually. So it's a complicated position, but I think it's important to understand. And I'll just add to this, I think it's important to understand because it is it's both theological and it's also loose in the kind of way that I think Jim wanted us to see. Like, it is a theology. I mean, it's connected to the idea that Christians will be persecuted, right? You will suffer for my sake, Jesus says. The idea, you know, Christians worship a God who was killed on the cross, right? So the idea that Christians are persecuted has deep theological roots, but it also has a kind of loose, effective sense that you don't have to be able to cite chapter and verse to be able to say, well, we know Christians have it bad here and there. And I've seen these pictures. I know it's bad. And it actually, it helps explain, I think, what is otherwise kind of inexplicable why, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why American evangelicals talk about themselves as, you know, the war on Christians, as themselves as suffering under, you know, discrimination. American evangelicals believe that as Christians, they are discriminated against more fully than they believe Muslims are discriminated against in the United States. So how do we understand that? And there are many ways, but one of them is to understand that there's this global conversation, and American Christians and American evangelicals have inserted themselves into it as being part of a persecuted community, persecuted globally, but then also, you know, they're after us here too. And so I think understanding that kind of larger affective and political framework might help us see Israel as part of a central part, but a part of a larger story about how American evangelicals are positioning themselves internationally.
Excellent. Really, really articulate and astute observation. Thank you. I think it's so interesting because I so agree with you the way that Christians, the narrative is framed Christians versus Muslims, right? And in a broad sphere. And of course, here in the U.S., the persecution is against a kind of quote, secular worldview. It's the secularism itself, which has its own complications, of course, given the roots of secularism are so deeply informed by Protestant Christianity itself. So this is a really interesting set of questions. The other thing I was going to add and ask if you would agree with this, Melanie, is that in my own teaching, I think the other reason why Palestinian Christians are not on the radar for people around persecuted Christians, aside from the fact that it would then, you know, it wouldn't fall into the Christian versus Muslim narrative, is that so many people are so unaware, literally, that Palestinian Christians exist, that there's an invisible way that they are just not recognized. So my students, astoundingly, actually have training, I teach graduate students, so they're not just coming right out of high school. Many are just surprised to learn that there are Palestinian Christians.
Yeah, and I think that this speaks to both, again, this kind of general problem of American education, but something I wanted to mention, which is another form of kind of soft Christian Zionism is through Holy Land tourism, which we were talking about earlier. Right. And so many Americans go to the Holy Land and they go through these tours that are primarily, very pro-Israel in their orientation. Yeah. If they meet any Palestinians, it's in highly compromised and limited ways. Yeah. And they come back with a sense of Israel is great. You know, Israel's great. They invented hummus, apparently. They have wonderful food. I mean, they are nice to us and they're protecting the Holy Land. And we get to go see all these places that are important to us. And so they tell a story that wipes Palestinians off of the map through these tours, even when it's not some big rah-rah, you know, apocalyptic end time story. I took several Holy Land tours as part of the research for Kingdom of God. And the stories are just like, here we are, this Israeli guide telling people, here we are, taking care of the land, see how beautiful it's blooming, see the wonderful Christian churches that I know all about as your guide and respect, and this is what Israel is to you. So again, there's all sorts of ways, and then even if you don't go on the tour, somebody comes back and talks about it, right, from the church, and so it becomes a kind of common sense knowledge that Israel is friendly, right, and Palestinians are invisible.
Yeah, great, good, really good points. Thank you. Just to move along, Jim, I'm going to come back to you. What are some of the patterns of convergences between Jewish settler lobbies and Christian Zionists in pressuring policymaking vis-a-vis Israel and Palestine? And where do you see disruptions to their rhetorical, or to their rhetorical and semiotic hold on the American discourse? For example, perhaps you can introduce recent shifts in Congress by the Squad, et cetera. Would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Let me make a couple points. To Melanie, I served on the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and lived through this every single day, the point you're talking about. And I brought at one point the Patriarch of Jerusalem to meet with the commission because he had a couple of little requests. It was the wall that was going through the Cremeson Vineyard. It was the fact that priests, when they would come in, had to choose between, they had to get a visa either to go to the West Bank or to Israel proper. They couldn't do both. And then there was the family unification issue in Jerusalem. My God, my commissioner colleagues started with him on, why aren't you using your position to speak to Hamas and tell them to stop with the rockets? Why are you singling out Israel for criticism? I mean, that was how damned indecent they were with him. They not only had blinders on, but it sort of got them almost viscerally upset that they were being challenged by a Christian about Christians in an area where they had already figured out this is where we are on this one. And you're right. It's a convergence of this persecution mindset and the anti-Muslim mindset, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, which become conflated in their mindset. And anything that threatens it threatens to unravel the whole fabric that is making sense to them at this point. And I found Trump interesting because when you talk about persecution, I mean, this was an entire movement based on grievance. It started with Nixon, and it was, you know, the blacks were out to get us, and they get everything, we don't get anything. And then it grew into every aspect of cultural, social, political, and economic dislocation had somebody or some group, identifiable group, that was the cause of it. And it manifested itself in this political movement. And what the religious right does is kind of sprinkle holy water on this mindset and give it a sort of elevates it in terms of its rhetoric. But it's the same ugly content. How does it play out in Congress? These aren't the smartest, they're not the brightest bulbs in the chandelier, these guys in Congress. That's one thing I've kind of learned along the way, is that never give them credit where they don't deserve it as sort of thinking people. They act reflexively in many instances. It's what's going to get me elected, what's going to keep me going here, where's the money coming from, who's going to cause trouble for me. And if you're a Republican, there are a number of issues you're not touching with a 10-foot pole, because you know where the money comes from and you know where the votes come from and you know who's going to give you a hard time. And so as that movement grew and became rather, I wouldn't say totalitarian, but quite authoritarian in the way that it maintains control over groupthink, there are articles of faith, if you will, that are not articles of faith in that I believe them deeply and I mold my life around, but I mold my political career around them, because it ain't safe to mess with them once I'm there and if I want to stay there. And Israel's one of them. Some of these guys couldn't find some of the issues we talk about. They couldn't find the places on a map, but it didn't matter. It as Melanie said, it's us and them. And if it was Muslim and Arab, then it was like it was them and let's go with us. And yeah, the Palestinian Christian, Greg, is uncomfortable. It's like, I remember I brought an Anglican priest in 78 when I was running the Palestine Human Rights Campaign, to meet with religious news reporters or a number of different, you know, from the AP and the Washington Post, those who covered religion. And the first question he got was from the AP guy, who said, "Now, you're an Arab Christian. That's interesting. When did your people convert?" And that was sort of the mindset that they were. Back then, it was ignorance. Now it's not ignorance so much as it's willed ignorance. I don't want to know. It doesn't help me to know. Why are you bringing these people to see me? It just unsettles things. I don't need to know this. And I think that that's pretty much where it is. Where Bernie and the squad and folks who are challenging on the progressive side, they're making it uncomfortable because they are challenging this fabric on the Democratic side. It's not a challenge on the Republican side at all. The control that the groupthink has on that side is pretty complete. I mean, to the point where it doesn't matter if I look out and I see the sun shining and Democrats say the sun's shining, they're going to say, no, it's not. It's going to rain. Or it's, you know, they can't, they won't let them pass a budget. They won't let them get appointments approved. They won't, you know, they're just going to stop the country because they don't want Joe Biden reelected. On the Republican side, on the Democratic side, rather, the groupthink is already unraveling. And it's unraveling because the demography of the Democratic Party is becoming more complex. Blacks think differently about issues than older middle class whites do in the Democratic coalition. You've got a range of issues, and Bernie gave voice to some of that, and the squad gives voice to some of it. Look at the squad. I mean, you have an African Muslim, you have a Palestinian Arab Muslim, you have a Puerto Rican, you have an African American from St. Louis, you've got an African American from Westchester County. I mean, you've got this people of color coalition coming together that is reflects the demographic views of their, you know, of their components of the country. Bernie was different in that regard because he tapped into that. I might say late to the game, because I've known Bernie for a while, and this wasn't an issue for him before he ran for president. But when he ran for president and saw that it resonated well, it was like he grew with the issue. He realized this is one that works. I can, my base wants this. And I think that as the Democratic Party moves on this, we're not going to see the same movement on the Republican side at all. Rather, what we'll see is a shrinking of the Republican base as younger people drift over. You know, in other words, the Republican hold over the ideology is solid, and they run it. I mean, Republicans are carnivores, and Democrats get eaten alive. Republicans will leave. Younger people will leave. People of color will leave. Republican women will leave. They will not tolerate this, anti-gay, anti-woman, anti-people of color agenda. The base will shrink, but the hold that this cohort of everything from neoconservative right, religious conservative right, and the big industrial money guys who are funding a lot of this stuff, That hold will remain solid. I don't see that breaking up on that side at all. And if you're a Republican member of Congress who wants to keep their money and the support that they'll give, you'll continue to stay on board with them.
You have been listening to a forum held at the Harvard Divinity School examining the role of Christian Zionism in supporting the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Thank you for joining us this morning on This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. and on KKRN in Northern California at 5 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with a struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. We will talk again next week.